Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, we discuss 150 years of botanical surveys on Penikese Island and how that history is helping shape the present-day mission of the Penikese Island School. But first, we take a deep dive into one of the six scientific research organizations based in Woods Hole, the Marine Biological Laboratory, known locally as MBL. Coincidentally, the field station for botanical surveys on Penikese Island directly inspired the formation of the MBL. Joining us to talk about the mission and work of the MBL is the director, Nipam Patel. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So describe the mission of the work of the MBL for those who may never have heard of the organization.
So the Marine Biological Laboratory is a basic biology institution. So we take great advantage of the fact that we are in a marine environment, but we do basic biology in areas like cell biology, developmental biology, neurobiology, microbiology. And our mission is both a research and education mission. So, you know, the MBL was founded in 1888 as a place that really had both of those things as a key component. And that's what we still do to this day. So we have resident researchers that study all sorts of areas of biology, but we're also really well known for the courses that we run, particularly in the summertime with courses that are geared towards graduate students and postdocs in the biological sciences. But increasingly, we've also started offering courses year-round that are also geared to undergraduates and high school students.
I was saying, high school, that's pretty new, the high school students,
yeah.
Which is exciting,
and
right?
It's a great program.
Yeah. Now, you're a biologist. Do you remember when you first heard of MBL and what originally brought you to the organization?
Yeah, this will be my 24th summer in Woods Hole, and I came 24 years ago. I was invited to lecture in the molecular evolution workshop course. And I came to that, had a great time here, interacted with the students in the summertime. And then subsequently, I was invited to teach in the embryology course. And I've been continually coming to be in the embryology course since then. I was course director for that course for a number of years, and I still have an amazing time participating in that.
I would say you're a biologist, but you're a teacher at heart, right?
I love to do it. I think, you know, I really fall into that category of people that believe that my research is also greatly enhanced by being an educator.
Yeah. Now, MBL scientists collect and study marine organisms because their unique biological characteristics and features can help us better understand human biology, evolution, and disease treatment. Share some examples of organisms used in the past for breakthrough science at MBL.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the idea is, again, that we do very basic research. So a lot of what we discover is far removed from the actual applications to humans. So sometimes it's hard to make those connections, and it takes time. But I can give you some, very solid examples. So, for example, the discovery of proteins that actually control the cell cycle that tell cells when to divide. Some of those key discoveries were made at the Marine Biological Laboratory in people who were studying surf clams and sea urchins. And so you think, well, that's a long ways removed from humans. And in fact, the goal of the research was not looking to cure some particular human disease or ailment. It was to understand fundamental basic biology. So what drives a cell to have an orderly pattern of cell division? And the reason that clams and urchins were really great is because you can get a whole lot of sperm and egg simultaneously from these animals, literally millions of them, fertilize them so that they're perfectly synchronous, and then take samples every few minutes and actually see the progression of how cells are going through their division. And then you can see proteins that go up and down. So Tim Hunt and Joan Ruderman were both here at the MBL participating in courses in physiology and embryology, and they made various contributions. Tim Hunt went on to win the Nobel Prize for that work. But, you know, if you looked at it back when he was doing it, there would be a big connection to what this is to human health. But, of course, understanding how cells divide and what controls that is important in thinking about things like cancer, where the pattern, where that process goes uncontrolled.
Yeah. Isn't that what science is? You know, you're discovering one area here. You make this discovery, which leads you in another direction. And, of course, proposes a whole bunch of more questions.
Right, and that's just one example.
Yeah, and then talk about MBL scientist Josh Rosenthal and his work with squid.
Right, so that's another great example where, you know, Josh is studying how squid edit their RNA. So normally we have this idea that you progress from the information in DNA and then it's transcribed into an intermediate called RNA, which is then read to make proteins. And usually in the textbook, the RNA is just an intermediate, copy intermediate. But in fact, it turns out that animals can change the message a little bit. Mm-hmm. And squid are particularly good at doing that. And so Josh has studied that process and trying to understand why the squid proteins are particularly good at doing that. And again, it has implications for human health. So if we can intervene in disease situations where we don't necessarily correct the DNA, but we can correct the message so that the protein still gets made properly, that could be a real breakthrough in treating certain diseases.
And we may even be able to learn, you know, how this change in our nerve cells interpret pain, right? Which could ultimately reduce our reliance on opioid pain
right.
treatments.
Right, well, that's one of the potential applications, right, is the thought that you could transiently tone down the receptors or the transmission system you use for pain, and that you could then... it's not permanent, and you could retract that treatment when you need to, and it's something that would be non-addictive. So mm-hmm. that's one example. And the squid is a great system because, you know, that giant axon has led to a lot of breakthroughs. And another example is, you know, the work by Ron Vail and his collaborators Jim Spudich and Michael Sheets, who discovered the proteins that transport other things down, up and down the axons. And it's another great mm-hmm. example where that is an animal where that particular attribute makes it great for doing that kind of research.
Right. So aside from squid and the clams that you mentioned, what are some of the different organisms that are found in local waters that scientists at MBL can use to further our understanding in human biology, health, and disease treatment?
So another great example comes from skates. So Andrew Gillis at the MBL is studying skates, and he studied them for a long time, trying to understand the evolution of body plans in vertebrates. But one of the things that's fascinating about skates is that they belong to a group of fish known as the cartilaginous fish, and their skeleton is made purely of cartilage, no bone. But they actually have evolved from fish that did have bones, so they don't turn the cartilage into bone. But skates can repair damage to their cartilage, but when they repair it as cartilage. This is a big problem in humans. If we damage cartilage or in a situation like arthritis where it becomes damaged, it often ends up regenerating as bone, which does not work well for what it's supposed to do. So Andrew has been identifying actually the molecular mechanisms that skates have that allow them to regenerate this as cartilage and keep it as cartilage. So that has obvious implications for helping humans. But again, it's using the local skate. Yeah. I should add that at this point now, we don't only focus on the local creatures. So we, you know, for the genetics approaches that we do, it's often good to have animals with rapid generation time. So increasingly, we've also turned to tropical species. So for example, the work we do with squid, some of it's done with the local squid that we collect, but increasingly more and more of it is done with the tropical squid that we raise in sort of contained facilities within the MBL. And that's proving to be a bigger and bigger part of what we do. So in addition to the big marine resource center, which keeps the local animals, we built an automated aquatic culture facility that can really maintain a lot of these tropical species in a really easy and simple system that keeps them very happy and allows us to have access to them.
It's cephalopods, right? There's so much we can learn
there. We've got the investment in cephalopods, but increasingly we've, you know, had things like Nematostella, which is a sort of a sea anemone, which ends up being a great system to study regeneration and other phenomena. I work also on a little crustacean. It originally, well, it lives all over the world in tropical waters. But we keep it because its generation time then is only about 2 months, and we can do all sorts of things. And so one of the things we've discovered in that animal is that it can regenerate its germline. So in most animals, if you lose your germline, i.e. the cells, the progenitor cells that make sperm and egg, that's it. You're sterile. But this animal, if we kill the germline, it can actually regenerate it and make perfectly good sperm and egg and have perfectly good progeny. So it's an example where we didn't set out to study that. We sort of stumbled upon this discovery. But again, the fact that it's a tropical species and has rapid generation time is great. And the other, of course, big breakthrough is all the technology that we can apply. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the things like CRISPR is a great example where that's made it that we can take all these animals that have this amazing biology, but now actually do very detailed functional experiments to really understand how they've solved these interesting problems.
So what do you consider some of the most exciting research happening at MBL? You're talking about some of it right now, but is there something really exciting going on?
Yeah, I think all of this. I think, mm-hmm. you know, what we've touched on with the RNA editing, the work that we do in cartilage. We have people that are also studying, for example, rotifers, where they're looking at what happens when when you have maternal aging. So it's an obvious problem in humans, right, mm-hmm. And in other animals. But it's, you know, a problem where in a lot of animals, if you want to study it, how can you study it over, you know, decades? But in something like rotifers, where the generations are very, very fast, right, you can actually look at what happens as a mother ages, what happens to the quality of her offspring. And so that's another exciting area that's going on at the MBL.
Yeah. Many people grew up spending their summers in Woods Hole and Falmouth because, you know, their parents or their grandparents would come to MBL each summer to do research. Tell us why MBL is such a summer destination for scientists.
Yeah, it's an amazing phenomena. And I think, you know, part of it is just its history, right, that it's had this long history of doing this. But I think some of the things that contribute to it, one is that it's in an interesting way, it's a low-stress environment in that you come and you do all these things. And, you know, it's amazing how much of it works, but there's not a lot of like, well, if it doesn't work, you know, it's a disaster mm-hmm. in some way, right? It's people actually talking, having a good time, but having a good time actually doing really intense science. And it's in that way, it's a pretty unique environment. I mean, there's a couple other places, like I've also been involved over the years at Cold Spring Harbor and Friday Harbor and a couple other places. But MBL has sort of that environment just at a totally different level. It's also a place where there's a lot of everyone sort of accepts each other really easily. So you have a Nobel Prize winner sitting next to a student, showing them how to do something. But, you know, they're very relaxed, and it's not like a very hierarchical place mm-hmm. in the summertime. Yeah. And you've got so many people with so many different backgrounds coming because we run all of these courses simultaneously. And that's part of the beauty is you'll end up with these sort of random conversations between people who meet each other or happen to just be, you know, over at one of the local coffee shops and then they overhear a conversation and then they jump in and say, oh. But the thing is that at a place like MBL, you can have that kind of interaction, have a great discussion. Then you can run back to the lab and actually do the experiments.
Yeah. You know, you said something when it doesn't work, it's not, you know, that's okay. And I think a lot of people don't understand that in science, there's a lot of doesn't work, right? You go down this road thinking, you know, looking in one direction and you have these amazing discoveries that you weren't expecting, but it doesn't always work.
No, and sometimes those experiments that don't work actually lead to an interesting discovery instead.
Yeah. MBL also offers educational courses, which you touched on, to undergraduate and graduate students. What are some of the educational programs offered, and what makes MBL a unique place to study?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, you know, in the summertime, we have what we call the advanced training courses. And those are some of the really long-running courses. So, like the courses we have in embryology and physiology have been going now for over 130 years. There are other courses that are very new, like we have a recent course in symbiosis that's just launched a couple years ago. It's doing great. So those are courses that are mostly geared towards graduate students and postdocs. And I think, again, what makes a lot of them very unique is that this incredibly interactive environment also that we have access to a lot of outstanding equipment. So when the students come here, they can jump on some of the very best microscopes in the world, both commercial microscopes and home-built microscopes. But generally, we're really well equipped. Our labs that we teach in are really designed for teaching mm-hmm. and not a typical research lab. And it's all crammed together in this one building, and so it's a fantastic environment. But one of the things that we've done over the last few years is that instead of leaving all of that just sort of sitting idly for most of the rest of the year, we're increasingly offering more and more courses. So we've had a long-running undergraduate course called the Semester of Environmental Science that has been going on, but we've expanded that. We have a new series called, Biological Discovery, and that's more geared towards like neuroscience and cell biology, developmental biology for undergraduates. So we're expanding on that. We have, in September, we have a bunch of classes that are run for UChicago students that happen to come all for that. But our other undergraduate classes the rest of the year, we've opened up to students from any institution that want to come. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'm really excited about is the high school
program. Yeah, I was going to say, what are you teaching the high school kids?
Yeah, everything. and I'm very motivated by that because when I was a high school student, my life was very much changed by having the opportunity to work in a lab, in a research lab. And I think what we're trying to do is really show high school students what science is really like. That it's not necessarily, the picture they get from a textbook of just mm-hmm. learning a lot of facts. It's really trying to do experiments and to be creative and imaginative. So we bring in the high school students for, it depends on the class. It can be as short as 3 days or as long as 6 days. And we have a class, for example, where we teach them about CRISPR. Mm-hmm. So they come in, they get lectures and they understand CRISPR, but the more important part is they sit in the lab, they learn to inject zebrafish and make mutants. So they learn how to actually, with their own hands, do some of these experiments, see the results. And then we get to have great discussions with them about the ethics of this, yeah. right? Because they see like how easy it is to do this, and then we can talk to them about it. I love teaching them, for example, also imaging. I put them onto like one of the confocals I have, and we say, well, it's, $400,000, please don't break it, but we're going to teach you to use it. And then we teach them to visualize their data on their own laptops using, freely available public software. And hopefully it really opens their mind to what they can do. And we offer it both to public school students and to private schools. And we've been very lucky that we've gotten generous donation from one of our board members and also from the state of Massachusetts to make it free to public school students in the area.
Yeah. But you can just see these kids getting hooked on science. They already like it, right? So it's what an opportunity. There has been talk at the federal level to reduce the percentage of federal grants that cover indirect costs for research. Before we talk about indirect costs, for those not familiar with how federal grants work, give us a quick explainer.
Yeah, sure. So, when you write a grant, you put in what we call the direct costs. So those are, for example, the salaries of the people actually doing the work, the cost of the reagents that you may need for the work, right? But you can only do the work because you have the facilities and the infrastructure to do it. And so when you write a grant, then there is an additional amount known as the indirect cost that comes with the grant. It depends on whether it's a National Science Foundation or NIH, the way that those work is a little bit different. But the idea is that that provides the money for the infrastructure and the support personnel that you need. So, for example, we talked about, working on all these different marine creatures, but we can only do that because we have facilities mm-hmm. and we have people that take care of those animals. And that's what the indirect costs help to pay for. And so without that, we really can't do the work.
Yeah. So how might reductions in indirect costs associated with federal research grants impact the ability of the scientists to carry out their work at MBL?
Yeah, so it would really reduce what we can do. So, the problem is that you can have the money for the people and the reagents, but if you don't have that infrastructure around you, you can't do it. And you also need people that help, in the grants management, keeping track of everything for you. And that's what the indirect costs pay for. And, we've negotiated that in the past. There's a system that set all of that up. And that's, the strength of the U.S. research program as a whole really depends on that environment.
Yeah. So how is the uncertainty impacting you then? Plan A, plan B, plan C?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, obviously, you know, as you said, uncertainty about what's happening. And so we obviously have contingency plans. But, you know, a lot of it is now just waiting to see what the final decisions are going to be.
Yeah. So if folks come to Woods Hole, are there opportunities to get a peek into the research and work of MBL if they're not scientists?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's fantastic that, you know, Woods Hole is also a great destination for people on vacation. And we really try to reach out and educate them at the same time. So, yeah, we offer tours. You can go onto the website. You can find out what's available. You know, there's opportunities. We have an amazing library that we run with HUI.
I was going to say, if you have to visit the MBL HUI Library, especially if you're interested in the history. And there's some stuff on exhibit there that people wouldn't expect. You know, you've got stuff about the Nobel Prize winners, which there are many from Woods Hole. It's a treasure trove of interesting
And it's fun just to see. I mean, like, for example, we've always had a great history of breakthroughs in imaging technology. And we have one of Shinya Inoue's, you know, microscopes there, which, of course, most people look at it and it just looks like a jumbled collection of pieces. But it was amazing what, you know, he was able to do with that. And that's one of the things that we have on display there in the library. I'd also encourage people, we have the Friday evening lecture series every Friday night during the summer. It's a great opportunity. So we have some of the top scientists in the world who are here, and they give a lecture. And it's an interesting and challenging lecture to give because they're trying to impress, you know, their colleagues who have Nobel Prizes who might be in the audience, as well as really explain their science to the public. I think most of them do a great job. But it's a really wonderful opportunity to engage scientists and the public.
Yeah. And they also get to get a glimpse, at least, at some of your butterfly collection that's hanging around there.
Unfortunately, there's not much of it on display right now. But yeah, I'm always happy to talk about butterflies with people because that's, you know, an example of a non-marine organism that's worked on at the MBL. And there are actually quite a lot of those. As I said, we take great advantage of being in the marine environment. But as a basic biology institution, you know, we go with whatever organism helps us answer the questions we want.
We'll post a link with more information about MBL, including the research using squid and RNA genes editing at our website, capeandislands.org. Nupam Patel is director of Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much.
Coming up after a break, 150 years of botanical surveys on Penakees Island.